Sometime in the early 1700s, a young boy named Jim Hawkins is working at his parents' inn, the Admiral Benbow, and has no idea that his life is about to change forever. A knock at the door announced the arrival of an old, gnarled sailor. He was tanned from life on the sparkling sea, except where a stark white gash from a cutlass strike broke up his right cheek. The gruff sailor sidled up to Jim's father and asked if they had many guests in this cozy little pocket of town. When Jim's father replied that, sadly, they had very few guests, the sailor decided that this was the place for him. He told them that he was a simple man and that all he wanted from them was rum, bacon, eggs, and privacy. He said that they may call him the captain and dragged his massive sea chest up to his room in a wheelbarrow. That was all the Hawkins family was to learn about their gruff guest for many months. One day, early in his visit, the captain motioned Jim toward him and promised the young lad a fourpenny piece a month on the first of the month if he would tell the captain of any seafaring men he encountered, especially ones with one leg. The captain was such a massive and intimidating figure that the idea of the one-legged man who frightened him so frightened Jim more. He had terrible nightmares about the vicious one-legged man. Sometimes his leg was cut off at the knee, sometimes at the hip. Sometimes he was a monster who had only ever had one leg, that emerged down from the middle of his body like a mermaid's tail. Whatever the situation of his leg, he moved with impossible strength and agility in Jim's dreams, and the unnaturalness of this often horrified him so badly that he was jolted awake by it. When the time came to receive his reward every month, Jim felt as though it was very hard-earned indeed. For the most part, the captain was easy to live with. He would spend his days overlooking the cliffs with his spyglass, eyes peeled for any other sailors. When the evenings came round, he would sit near the fire and drink rum while everyone else in the inn had their dinner. Once in a while, he would have a little more rum than he could hold and would slam his hand hard against the table, a gesture meant to demand silence from everyone in the room. He would then loudly sing his old sailing tune. 15 men on a dead man's chest. Yo ho ho and a bottle of rum. Drink and the devil and have done with the rest. Yo ho ho and a bottle of rum. He would demand that everyone in the inn join him in song, and no one was to leave the tavern until he had gone to bed for the night. More troubling, however, was his tendency to avoid payment. He would dilly-dally, but eventually pay Jim his monthly fourpenny. But his father was not so lucky. Mr. Hawkins would attempt to collect his payment, only to be stared down by the fearsome sailor before he retreated, wringing his hands with anxiety. He was just as struck by the violent old man as all of the rest of the guests of the Benbow Inn were, and Jim began to fear that their hostile exchanges were beginning to affect his father's health. He assumed this because they suddenly started receiving visits from Dr. Livesey. He remembers this specifically because this triggers the first time he saw just how quick to anger the old sailor could be. He had had a bit too much rum, as I'm sure you've guessed, and Dr. Livesey was having a conversation with another guest when the captain slammed his head against his table, to which all the tavern visitors knew to mean he wanted silence. Dr. Livesey knew no such thing, and continued his conversation clearly and at an even volume. Everyone stared as the captain screamed at the doctor to be silent. The room trembled at his booming voice, but the doctor was completely unfazed and simply asked if the captain was addressing him. When the captain's response was to demand silence again, the doctor replied that if he continued to drink so much rum, the world would soon be rid of a dirty scoundrel. Outraged, the captain leapt unsteadily to his feet and pulled a dagger from his pocket, threatening to pin the good doctor to the wall. While the frightened guests' heads comically bounced back and forth between sides of the argument, the doctor didn't bat an eyelash. He simply stated that, as he was also the magistrate, he would be visiting the Benbow Inn often to keep an eye on the old man. At this, the old man cowed, and the Hawkins had no more trouble from him for several days. Despite the quiet, Jim's father's health did not seem to improve. Jim and his mother had taken on all the duties of running life at the inn while his father was bedridden, so he barely paid any attention to the captain. At least, not until the captain had gone out on one of his daily walks and a stranger came to the Benbow Inn. When the captain returned, the man had a shouting match with him in the back room. Jim was unable to hear anything other than shouted curses. Suddenly, the table overturned and the other man ran from the room, clutching a deep gash in his shoulder, while the captain screamed at the man, Black Dog, to come back and fight like a man. He swung a mighty blow at the pirate with his cutlass and missed and chopped a wedge out of the sign to the Benbow Inn. He panted raggedly for a few minutes, then collapsed to the ground. Jim and Mrs. Hawkins ran to the captain, only to find that he was alive, but they could not reawaken him. His jaw was too tightly clenched to pour a drop of his beloved rum down his throat. Jim and his mother were afraid that the captain would die until Dr. Livesey arrived to check on Mr. Hawkins. He sent Mrs. Hawkins upstairs to make sure her husband had not been disturbed by all the commotion, then began to undress the captain's arm. Jim fetched a basin, as the doctor procured a lancet, and together they drained a great deal of blood from the captain's arm. This decreased his blood pressure, which had risen high enough to give him a stroke. Together, they hauled the old man to bed, where the doctor told the captain that if he had one more glass of rum, he wouldn't be able to stop himself and it would kill him. Then he retreated upstairs to see Jim's father. Jim tried to keep an eye on the captain while the doctor saw to his father. Immediately the old man asked for rum, and Jim intended to deny it, but he raised about such a fuss about his shaking hands and hallucinations that Jim began to fear for his father and gave the captain what he wanted. This seemed to bring the old man to enough for him to realize that he needed to escape. He told Jim that he had once been the first mate to a pirate captain named Flint, and that upon the old scoundrel's deathbed in Savannah, he had given his mate the map to his treasure, and now he trusted Jim that should the remains of Flint's crew come for him, or give him the black spot, Jim was to go see the doctor, yes, the doctor, and tell him everything and give him the contents of the chest. Jim knew that he should tell his mother everything right away, but every thought of the old captain left his head when Dr. Livesey and Mrs. Hawkins gave him the terrible news. His father had passed away. Jim was just a boy, now a broken-hearted boy, and his mind was all used up with taking care of his father's final arrangements while continuing to run the Admiral Benbow. In his sorrow, Jim stood in the fog thinking of his father when he was reminded of the pirate situation when he heard the tap, tap, tap of a walking stick coming towards him. A ghastly figure with the cloth wrapped around its eyes came struggling towards Jim. The blind man appeared wispy and feeble until Jim revealed to him that he had arrived at the Admiral Benbow, when with sudden, surprising agility, he grabbed and twisted Jim's arm painfully. He forced Jim to lead him to the old captain, despite Jim's warnings that the old captain was very foul-tempered since his stroke. Unrelenting, the haunting old man forced his way into the drunk captain's room, and the sight of him instantly sobered the old scoundrel. His hands trembled as the blind man handed him a small piece of paper, then turned with shocking agility and bolted from the room. The captain held a circle of paper completely blacked out on one side, the black spot. The captain weakly tried to get out of bed, stating that he had until 10 o'clock. He could still cheat them again, and he would. No sooner had he climbed roughly out of bed when he collapsed and breathed no more. A final stroke had taken him, just as the doctor said it must. Jim's mother ran into the room at the crashing sound, and now, finally, Jim told her everything. Together, Jim and his mother immediately ran into town in the thick, sticky fog clinging to their hair. They told their story to everyone in town, and though many offered to go to Dr. Livesey with a messenger, none would return to the inn with the Hawkins to help them. The name of Captain Flint meant little to Jim, but apparently it meant a great deal to the people in town, and cowardice was contagious. Mrs. Hawkins scolded the group of big, strong men for having no honor and being less men than her little child. She was going back to the inn one way or another to claim the rent that was due to her, and she would not be dissuaded. This was how Jim and his mother found themselves alone in their dark inn, the door locked behind them, and the dead pirate before them. After searching the old scoundrel, they found the key to the captain's old sea chest around his neck and crept upstairs to open the trunk. Inside, they found a nice set of clothes, a few pretty seashells from some foreign country, and a small patch of coins. Jim's mother fumbled greedily through the coins for her share. Unfortunately, it was a confusing mix of coins from all over the world, and it was taking her quite a long time to sort through it. When Jim begged her to take it all, she shushed him, saying it was only 7 p.m. and she was going to take exactly what was owed to her. She knew her rights. Jim was about to counter that the murderous pirates may not agree with her about what exactly her rights were, when he silenced her instead, as he heard the dreaded tap, tap, tap of the blind man's walking stick. It tapped its way to the door of the Benbow Inn and struggled heartily with the lock before slowly tap, tap, tapping its way into the distance. Jim knew the locked door would rouse suspicion and begged his mother to go, but she had never met the blind man and had not learned to be afraid of him. She stubbornly but slowly picked through the coins, demanding her fair share, until presently they heard a low whistle sound from the nearby that was enough for both of them. Jim took up the small oilskin package at the bottom of the trunk to make up the difference in what his mother was owed, and together they plunged back into the early morning fog. As they ran from the inn, they thanked the Lord for the fading fog, as they could hear the pirates burst into the inn almost as soon as they had left it. Jim and his mother dove into a ditch where the low elevation was where the fog was thickest and crawled clumsily under a small bridge where Jim's mother dissolved into a faint. From this location, Jim could easily still hear everything happening in the inn as the pirates remarked in surprise that the door was open, followed by their rage at finding the chest had been ravaged. They knew immediately that the Hawkinses had taken what they were after, and they tore the inn apart looking for them. The monsters were just giving up on the inn and beginning to search outside when two more whistles sounded over the horizon. The pirates knew this to mean that they were about to be caught, and they all scattered except for the blind man, who berated them for being so easy to scare off. Then, finding himself alone, he whined, "No, lads, you wouldn't leave old Pew alone. Not old Pew." He tapped his stick this way and that, searching. To Jim's horror, the man began tapping straight towards him and his mother, and while the man couldn't see them, Jim's mother was not well hidden beneath the bridge, and Jim could neither move her nor wake her. He thought they were done for when one of the messengers they had sent for Dr. Livesey, a Mr. Dance, took the corner so quickly that he ran down the man, killing him instantly beneath the hooves of the horses. At first, Mr. Dance was horrified by the incident until Jim explained exactly who he had struck. He helped Jim get his mother into the cart, and together they went to Dr. Livesey. Livesey was found at an inn with Squire Trelawney. The two men were pleased to hear of Jim's adventure and that he had gotten away safely. Together, the three of them opened the oilskin package to find a book and a sheet of paper. The book contained Captain Flint's balance book, leading them to believe that the pirate had amassed an incredible fortune, and the paper was a map to the exact location where this treasure was kept. This was an exciting reveal even for the normally calm and collected Dr. Livesey. Together they made basic plans to go and search for the treasure, and the three swore each other to secrecy before Jim and his mother were fed and sent to bed. Dr. Livesey even paid to repair and refurnish the Admiral Benbow once Mrs. Hawkins had her rhythm back, and Jim was sent to Bristol. While waiting for Dr. Livesey to catch up with them, the squire sent Jim to deliver a message to the ship's cook, Long John Silver, upon whom the squire had heavily depended for staffing the ship. Once they knew about the unique treasure they were after, they were all on board. Jim was concerned by this, since they weren't supposed to tell anyone about the treasure, but he assumed the adults knew what they were doing and trotted off to deliver his message. He was curious about this Long John Silver anyway. Squire Trelawney had mentioned that he had lost his leg in the service of the king. The old captain's voice rang in his head, telling him to be wary of a seafaring man with one leg. Could Long John be the man that the old man and Captain Flint were so afraid of? One look at the clean, jovial businessman, and Jim was put at ease. He had seen Black Dog and Blind Pew, and he knew a scoundrel when he saw one. John Silver was not at all what he expected. He approached and gave the cook his message, and went out of the corner of his eye, he saw a man speedily rise from his drink and dart out of the pub. Black Dog! Jim told Long John about the scoundrel, and he sent some of his men to catch the pirate. Long John was so shocked and angry to see a pirate in his inn that he cursed his missing leg and crutch. Overall, he was so moving that by the end of the meeting, Jim would have testified in court on behalf of the man's innocence. Together, they reported the incident to the doctor and the squire, then the men agreed to set sail at 4 o'clock tomorrow. The first sign of trouble came when they met Captain Smollett for the first time. He was a very direct man, and those who communicate very bluntly are usually very honest, but also usually not very well liked. He met with Jim, the doctor, and the squire and told them directly that he didn't like the voyage and he didn't like the crew. Squire Trelawney asked if perhaps he didn't like the ship, and the captain said he couldn't say until he had actually tested her. Flustered, the squire countered that perhaps the captain didn't like his employers. Here, Dr. Livesey intervened to prevent a fight and asked the squire to be patient and hear the man out. He then calmly asked the captain what he didn't like about the voyage. The captain said that he was hired on sealed orders, meaning that he was to sail for his employer without knowing the ends of the journey. A secret mission, if you will, only to find that when he came aboard that every sailor, low and high, knew where they were going and that they were going there for treasure. He was very uncomfortable with the entire crew knowing more about their journey than the captain did. The good doctor agreed with this, and the squire acted very scandalized that anyone had leaked the details of their mission, though both Jim and the doctor knew that it was his own loose lips that had put them in this predicament. Seeing that they didn't argue with his first point seemed to make the captain feel more comfortable to make his second, the crew. Not only were these men privy to information that they shouldn't be, but the captain was a bit chapped that he had not been involved in the hiring process, since he knew what to look for in a reliable crew, and it was hardly traditional to have such things be put to the cook. The doctor conceded this as well, and asked what could be done to put the captain's mind at ease, while the squire was still puffing, having taken offense to the captain's candor. The captain wished for all arms and munitions to be moved to the cabin so that they would be unavailable to the crew, from which they all gathered that he feared mutiny. This, again, chafed the squire, but as the doctor saw the sense in it, it was done. The second sign of trouble came in the form of Mr. Arrow, the first mate. He was a good deal too close to the crew, and as such, they saw him as a peer rather than as a respected leader. What was worse, the man nearly always seemed to be drunk, though no one could detect where he was getting the drink from. He behaved so poorly that, as often as not, he was relieved from duty to rest below decks. He was so constantly tipsy that when a terrible storm hit the ship, no one was surprised when afterwards he was nowhere to be found. Jim was granted no favoritism on the ship and was forced to work much harder than he had ever had to work at his father's inn. Still, he was happy to spend time with Long John and his parrot, which he had named Captain Flint. One exhausted evening, after a particularly grueling day, Jim went to treat himself to an apple from their barrel, but when he found the barrel nearly empty, he was forced to climb inside to retrieve one. What he heard there would change the entire journey. It would change his life. So I hope you're enjoying the story so far. I'm sorry if there were any sounds as I was reading. Oliver decided today that he wants his head on my lap while I read the story. He is such a big baby, but his head takes up almost my whole lap. He is a Newfoundland mix, so he's a pretty big guy, and so I've kind of had to shuffle around him while trying to read this script that I put on the iPad. So I hope that you didn't get too distracted by any shuffling around or heavy panting dogs or anything like that while I was reading, and I hope you're enjoying the story. Young Jim here has to adapt pretty quickly to a massive shift in his world that begins the moment the captain, that is Billy Bones, enters his life. Over the course of a year, he met a pirate, lost his father, and is off to sea searching for treasure. The loss of his father may have him subconsciously searching for a father figure, and he has several options in Long John, Dr. David Livesey, or Captain Alexander Smollett. Squire Trelawney is never considered, according to most reviewers, and I think that this is partially because he's not a potential image of masculinity for Jim. He is a man, of course, but he's prone to gossip away confidential information. He's easily offended and petulant, and this, coupled with his naivety, makes him too easy to fool and manipulate for even a boy like Jim to see him as a leader or a role model. We see several examples of, even in the book's early chapters, that despite his youth, Jim already finds the squire a bit silly and foolish. This is saying something because both Jim and the Squire are fooled by Long John. This story is an adventure tale, but it's also kind of a coming-of-age tale of how Jim grows from being a lost boy, learning to survive in a hard world, to becoming a man. His choice of a father/mentor figure is crucial to his growth because without his father, this mentor will play a key role into the man that he will become. Indeed, with our three candidates, we see three very different worldviews. Long John seems like a warm, friendly, fun uncle figure, and he embodies all the wildness and untamed potential that everyone has inside them, but little boys are especially drawn to. He is cunning enough to be more in control of himself than we see with most of the brutal pirates in the story, but he also retains a childish selfishness. In this way, it's as though he is in a state of arrested development somewhere in adolescence. He has more self-control than the wild but playful child, yet he has not embraced the mature masculinity that comes with providing for and protecting those around you and accepting them as your responsibility. Long John likes Jim, but Long John always puts Long John first and always will. He teaches Jim about life at sea and how to think for himself, and I believe he accidentally teaches Jim to be a little less trusting of others. On the opposite end of the spectrum from Squire Trelawney is Captain Smollett. Smollett is reliable, stern, and even a bit cold. His view is much more world-weary. He is prone to pessimism, especially where other people are concerned. He is serious and rigid. He hates rule-breaking, and later says he doesn't think that he and Jim should sail together again because he's afraid that he would treat the boy with favoritism. This reluctance almost makes him seem uncomfortable with affection, perhaps as a result of his rigid rule-following. Finally, we have perhaps the best mentor in Dr. David Livesey. We see that the doctor is not offended by the captain's concerns about the voyage, but rather listens and seeks to help, as he knows that being easily slighted will not be useful when they are all trapped in close quarters for weeks. He says that he considers Jim a friend despite their age difference and never treats him like a child or a burden. Rather, he keeps Jim informed on all that is going on and includes him in decisions respecting his opinions. He is the town magistrate and takes the well-being of his community seriously, as seen by him and Mr. Dance purging the pirates from the Benbow Inn, then taking it upon himself to see the inn restored, painted, and well-furnished so that Mrs. Hawkins would be set up to succeed while they're all gone to sea. His attention never seems forced or condescending, no matter who he's giving it to, but he gives everyone a fair shot without being naive. In short, he is a good leader because he sees himself as a member of a team, no matter what his circumstances, and not as a superior. We also see in his interaction with Billy Bones that he has no problem standing up to others and will not take nonsense from anyone, no matter how scary they may be. His good manners and education also tip the scale in his favor, making him the best masculine, mature mentor figure for Jim. That being said, he does also fall for the trick of trusting Long John, and we'll just have to see what comes of that. Do you remember my Pirates of Savannah episode? It is thought that the famous pirate's house in Savannah that I discussed in the Ghosts of Savannah episode was the same inn that inspired Robert Louis Stevenson to write about in his portrayal of the death of Captain Flint, where he gave his precious treasure map to Billy Bones. This building was infamous for pirate traffic, and now for its ghost traffic and delicious food. You should definitely stop in if you ever get the chance. If you're ever in Savannah, maybe you'll meet Captain Flint. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I can't wait to talk about the rest of this story with you. I've broken it up into about four parts because it is a pretty long story. I mean, it is a children's novel, but it is a novel. So, you know, I think it's about 220 to 250 pages. Definitely too much for me to cover in any sort of appropriate amount of detail in any one podcast, because you definitely want to hear it and kind of pick at where it kind of differs from any movie adaptations you've seen or where it is the same. For example, the character of Dr. Livesey is often kind of excluded from more children-oriented versions of Treasure Island, such as Treasure Planet or Muppet Treasure Island. Muppet Treasure Island, he's excluded completely, whereas in Treasure Planet, he's kind of morphed with the character of Squire Trelawney. Like, the two of them together have become kind of one well-meaning but bumbling kind of character. And so it's kind of interesting to see the different approaches they have to the different characters and to the storyline, depending on the media they're depicted in and the kind of length of time they have to tell the story. You'll have to tell me what you think and what your favorite version of Treasure Island is. Thank you so much again for tuning in, and have a wonderful, wonderful weekend.